Do you want the title?
The first one I'm going to read.
I'm writing this from my mother's apartment.
It's called Orange.
All I could think about was being written into her life story.
She made up a story back
What
in
was the inspiration
home.
For the story?
My story is called Cigarettes.
What was the genesis?
Testing. I used to be almost dependent
Dear B,
on voice.
A speaker and a poem. I want to talk to you.
And the conversation starts.
Hello, and welcome to Off the Page, a podcast featuring the fiction, poetry, and creative nonfiction of the Stanford writing community. In each episode, a writer will read from their work and then have a conversation about the craft behind the creation. I'm your host, Mark Lebowski, Jones Lecturer in the Creative Writing Program at Stanford. In this episode, Isaac Vaught reads his essay, The Burden of Bad Men, which won first place in the 2020 Undergraduate Creative Nonfiction Contest here at Stanford. Isaac Vaught graduated in 2020 from Stanford University, where he received the Creative Nonfiction Prize. He is currently an MFA candidate in fiction at Florida State University.
This piece is called The Burden of Bad Men.
I used to tell people that I didn't have a dad. Of course, I knew as a kindergartner that everyone technically has a dad, but I never felt like it was worth it to stop playing Ninja Turtles just to have to explain to my friends that my dad was in prison and that I had no memories of him or even what he looked like. I'd learned after a while that other kids had trouble understanding me when I said this. Even when they did understand, it would usually be followed by, "But I thought you couldn't have babies if you weren't married." Somehow they thought it was easier to believe I was conceived immaculately. I wanted a more satisfying explanation, but I had nothing to give them. No pictures, no stories, no, well, my dad says. In fact, at the time I really only knew three things about my father. One, he wasn't white like my mother. Two, he was in jail for robbing someone. And three, in his jail you could mail things. The one thing I ever remember receiving from him was a small card with an impressive drawing of Spider-Man perched on a chimney. I assume he found out from my mom who my favorite superhero was. "Happy birthday, son," wasn't a meaningless message to me, but without a history to attach to it, it was like the words came from a void, a message from an eight ball shaken in the dark. To be honest, I didn't think about him much, but the part of my mind that would occasionally bring him up did have some longing. If not for him, then at least for the chance to hear another kid use the word dad, without feeling like I was an alien. When I was six, I got my wish, sort of. What they don't have the heart to tell a kid is that an incarcerated parent never really comes home. When my dad finally got out of his second sentence, serving 4 years from the time I was two to the time I was six, people talked about the wrong things. They'd talk about how much muscle he'd gained or how good he looked in his new glasses, but no one ever talked about how his eyes looked like sewer lids sealing off black holes, or how the art on his walls included more decapitated heads than it did flowers, or how he never showed his teeth in pictures, and the lip-sealed smile that took their place curved slightly unevenly on either side of his mouth, like a snake on the hunt. He functioned normally enough on the outside. He found an apartment, a job, a girlfriend. But it didn't take me long to see the restless demon doing gymnastics inside of him, trying to claw its way out from the inside of his chest. It never allowed anything new in his life to last very long. Shortly after he'd gotten out and found some stability, around about the time I was getting ready to turn seven, I started spending half the week with him. The first apartment I remember him having was deep basement level, and the only windows were so high up on the wall you could see a thin layer of sod underneath the outside world. It was here, when I was close to turning seven and getting ready to enter the first grade, that he gave me the first of many life lessons from the joint. To help me prepare for school, he gave me a warning. Anyone trips me, I needed to pop right back up and punch them in the face. To make sure I knew what I was doing, he had me practice falling forward and then getting up as fast as I could to knock down the air. My mom wasn't happy when I told her about what I'd learned, and this would be the first of many clashes over how to raise me. The last thing she wanted was for her kid to end up in the principal's office, and the last thing he wanted was for his kid to be weak. But as I got older, he got more pushback from me. When I was around 11, things between us got pretty heated after he found out I told my stepdad about his plans to secretly move out and not tell his girlfriend until the day of. He grilled me for being a snitch. I could get myself killed for that shit. I shouldn't meddle in other people's business. You see someone getting jumped, you just pretend like you don't see it. I got angrier with him than I ever had before, not understanding how he could live and think with no heart, like the world had already ended and we were just scavengers who had to be ruthless to get our share of the scrap heap. He hated dealing with crying, so he left me in the car to harden up. After he came back, we had an understanding. The experience divide between us was too wide for me to cross. I had it easy. He was the one who really knew about people. I could do book stuff, but he knew the streets, and I had to stay in my lane. I had no common sense, and he made sure I always knew that. Even as a free man, he saw everything from behind bars. The world was one big jail that I would never survive in. Not being thug enough is a strange insecurity to have. Any kind of speaking around him became speaking out of turn. He was prone to hot and cold flashes. Anything and everything could become irritating, and you could play whack-a-mole trying to guess his next mood. If I walked on my toes, he'd tell me to stop acting like a girl. If I put a weird number of seconds on the microwave, he'd question why. If I took time to look for something I'd lost while trying to get my things together when he came to pick me up for his half of the week, he'd leave because I was taking too long and tell me he'd come back the next day. I learned to become stone-faced. I was silent and indifferent to his choices. So when we started living with a married woman while her husband was away fighting in Afghanistan, I didn't say anything. When I caught them making out and he told me they were just friends and she was just letting us stay with her while her husband was away, I pretended to go along with it. I had no opinions, because anything I said would be weak and dumb. I was weak and dumb. I never thought I'd be strong enough to earn the right to speak. I'd never understand how to be like him. He went back to prison when I was 13. Another attempted robbery. This time I got to see the whole process again, but now I had the ability to remember. His sentencing hearing was the last time I would see him in person for 5 years. I remember the one glance we exchanged. He was across the room in a navy blue jumpsuit, with the first beard I'd ever seen on him. It was also the first time I'd ever seen hesitation in his eyes. He really wanted to see me, just not like this. I was told I might get to hug him before he went off, but the judge said no. The first time we talked, he was sent back inside. He told me he was innocent. The police just had it out for him. To be fair, this wasn't unreasonable. He'd had more run-ins with the West Lafayette Police Department than he was proud of. He would eventually admit to me, after he got out years later, that he really had done it, but I never knew exactly what it was. I knew it was some kind of robbery, and he told me that he was serving as the lookout for his now former friend and roommate, Tracy. My collection of memories of Tracy hasn't had any new entry since 2010, and no one I know has seen or heard from him since then. He worked nights in the brief time that he shared an apartment with my dad, so times when both of us were awake were scarce. But when I did see him, it was like seeing a feral cat in the woods with a rusted collar. I had the sense that he belonged somewhere once, but whether he'd cut ties with them or they'd cut ties with him, I couldn't tell. Either way, he was wild now, and he was comfortable there. For all I knew, Tracy's life was like a half-size dresser. It had a modest but sturdy build, with a few neat compartments to keep everything safe and separate. In one drawer was a girlfriend who never came by. The apartment was small enough that I'd occasionally hear phone arguments between them, which sounded less like fights than they did like him trying to console a time bomb. In another drawer was an infatuation with martial arts and a collection of weapons. There were two samurai swords, one big brother and one little brother, sitting in front of the fireplace, and on the wall sat what could have either been a very small sword or a very large knife. He demonstrated for me a couple of times, pretending to take down his attackers with swift justice. Finally, World of Warcraft got the big bottom drawer all to itself. After my father was caught and Tracy wasn't, he took on more jail time for refusing to give Tracy up. He told me that was the last thing he would ever do for Tracy, and that was the end of what I would find out from him. Oddly enough, the source that would give me the missing information was Google. A simple search of my dad's name revealed the case file for his attempt at an appeal. The appeal for the decision in Mark Van Rollen versus State of Indiana was filed on August 22, 2011. As I open it, I feel like I've just rubbed a genie lamp. The file opens with a case summary. Mark Van Rollen appeals his convictions for attempted burglary as a Class C felony and resisting law enforcement as a Class A misdemeanor in an attendant adjudication that he is a habitual offender. I read on for the full story. In the early hours of June 17, 2009, Alex Huang, a local college student, was spending the night alone in his family's comic book store. Around 1:45 a.m., he called his mother, Rose, after being startled by the sounds of sawing, banging noises, and voices near the back of the shop. They talk and shrug it off as construction work or garbage possibly being hauled away. However, soon after, Alex heard the sounds of Velcro, zippers, and more voices. Is there a door alarm? I don't think there is. Is this all we found in the closet area? Once Rose heard this, she called the police and started driving towards the business with her father. Alex was, as he would later state to the court, extremely frightened and broke into tears. About 35 minutes after Alex Huang first heard noises from the back of their store, two police officers arrived at the scene. They approached the building, peeked around its side, and saw my father peeking back at them. As I read, I imagine the pregnancy of this moment, a startled halt, a hand on a gun, the vision of my father in the dark, the knowledge that either person could be the last one the other ever sees. I imagine the fear Officer Williams must have felt. Dad is 6'1" and, at the time, nearly 200 pounds of pure muscle. He's a formal martial arts instructor. One morning in the fourth grade, before he took me to school, I watched him do 55 consecutive pull-ups while holding onto a wooden beam with only his fingertips. I wonder how many times in his career on the force Williams ever feared for his life. I wonder if he's ever had to pull the trigger on someone. Most of all, I wonder if he would have done it to my father if he'd charged. But after this glance exchange, he takes off. The officers chased him on foot, which I can only imagine was less than fun given his athleticism. They yell out after him and identify themselves as police officers, but he doesn't stop. After some time, my father reached a clearing near a shopping center and got down on the ground to comply with the officers. This part marks the first time I ever really questioned the street smarts he always bragged about. As he was being taken into custody, without prompting, he told them, "I wasn't breaking into anything." After further questioning, he gave this statement. "I came from State Street, walked all the way down through here, and I was out. I was walking in front of here, and then I walked back behind there, came out to in front of it, was walking that way, back around the building. I did not do shit. I just walked through here. That's what I do." He insisted he knew nothing about any attempts to break into the store, and that there was no one with him. But soon enough, Officer Williams discovers a small walkie-talkie in his pocket. Without identifying himself, he calls in to ask the other end of the line where they are. "Stay quiet. I'm walking north up the street." A moment of silence. "Who is this?" Tracy was never heard from again. The police conducted an on-foot search of the area for the mysterious voice on the radio, but turned up nothing. They asked my father who it was. "That was nobody. I honestly don't have anybody on there. I just, you know, because sometimes I can pick up people talking on it." When later asked why he ran from the police, he said, "I seen the police and I was like, what the fuck? So I ran, just like anybody else would. But I really shouldn't have ran because I didn't have anything. I didn't do anything." By the end of their burglary attempt, the back door of the Huang store had been sawed nearly in half. A hole had been cut into the wall of their business's storage space, and several other businesses in the shopping center had small but new dents in the metal of their back doors. A saw and black tactical vest with a zipper and Velcro straps were found ditched in the woods behind the store, along with a window punch, compressed air cartridges, a compass, a set of cold chisels, binoculars, caltrops, a pocket knife, and a pry bar. Nothing was stolen. As he was being placed in the police car, the officer discovered flakes on my father's hands that matched the insulation on the walls on the Huang store, as well as the flakes on the ditch saw. Dad insisted that they got there after he got on the ground for the police earlier. A week later, On June 24, 2009, the state charged him with attempted burglary and resisting law enforcement. He was found guilty of both crimes by a jury on September 3, 2010. At his sentencing hearing on October 20, 2010, 3 days after my 13th birthday, and 4 days before his 36th, after considering letters of testimony both in favor of my father and highlighting the stress of the crime brought upon the Huang family, he was sentenced to 7 years. However, once they considered his status as a habitual offender, his sentence was more than doubled to a total of 15 years, 11 in prison and 4 on probation. His appeal a year later, on which the file focuses, was denied with the following concluding statement. Nor does Roland's character speak particularly well of him. He has an extensive history of juvenile delinquency adjudications, 2 prior convictions for burglary, 2 prior convictions for theft, a prior conviction for receiving stolen auto parts, and a history of probation violations. He has not earned a GED or high school diploma. Prior to his conviction, Roland had had regular employment to which he hopes to return upon release from prison and began to seek mental health counseling in September 2009. Roland has a 14-year-old son with whom he has a good relationship, but his pre-sentencing report indicates that he owes nearly $11,000 of prior unpaid child support obligations. While we recognize that Roland has taken steps to improve his life, we cannot say that these recent improvements in his character so outweigh the nature of his offense and his prior criminal history such that the trial court sentence is inappropriate. For the next several years, we'd have the same conversation on the phone every few months. He'd talk about movies with me for a bit, even though he hated them, because he knew that I was in my element talking about them. I'd hear about how I needed to stay in school, keep doing what I was supposed to do because that's what I was always good at. Occasionally, he'd tell me what was going on in his part of town. Some dude in the cell next to me tried to hang himself. He once told me a couple years in, "You'll never catch me doing that type of shit." I thought things would be different when he got out the next time. He'd been approved for early release for good behavior, even though he'd only served roughly 5 years of his original 11 years. I was about to turn 18, and I thought I'd grown wings and claws since I last saw him. I thought the scared kid he knew was gone and buried in a black box with the key melted down into a paperweight. I opened the door to see him for the first time and realized we were finally at eye level with each other. I thought maybe that meant I was finally enough of a man to be comfortable around him, that there was no need to be afraid anymore. But soon it all started up again. The volatile moods, the condescension, the shutting down. It was like his mind had put me in an icebox for 5 years and then thawed me out. I was hemorrhaging my years of extroversion, and I didn't know what to do. One day I realized that things weren't just sliding back, they were exactly the same. About a month after he got out, he looked at me at dinner and said, "I just don't understand you, man." He'd been talking to his friend about it. It was like he couldn't understand how I was his son. In a way, this made sense, given that the only thing we ever really had in common was that we were both good at clogging and unclogging toilets. I went back to my old responses. I had nothing to say. I wasn't strong enough to scale the bastion between us. We could only communicate through the same little peephole in it that we'd always used, too small to speak and understand at the same time. Sometime during the same summer that my father was released, I went to visit his side of the family and went out to dinner with Mimi, his adoptive mother, and my cousin Jackson. It was always convenient to see all of them because they all lived together. His adoptive parents, who everyone but Dad calls Mimi and Frampy, he prefers to call them Herb and Linda, my Aunt Stephanie, their biological daughter, Stephanie's husband Jose, and their 2 children, my cousins Jackson and Gracie, all under one roof. All of them except Dad. I became really good friends with Jackson when we were little, so I would see them often. And whenever I was there, Dad had one hard rule. If any of them asked me how he was doing, I was just supposed to say, "He's doing fine." If they asked any further clarifying questions, I had to say, "I don't know. You'll have to ask him." Given my obligations to our unofficial non-disclosure agreement, I was never able to have a real conversation about him with his side of the family. I'd only ever get small snippets of the past. Something like, when Mark was little, his shits were so big, Mimi would sometimes have to put on gloves and break in and reach in to break them apart so they would flush. Or, "Mark and your mom were really cute together. They used to stay up late playing cards and go to get Taco Bell at 2 in the morning. One time, when I was 12, Dad came to pick me up from their house. On our way out, we ended up in a long conversation together, where he and the family, for one of the only times I'd ever witnessed in my life, sat down and laughed together about the past. One time, Dad was so hungry he took a pack of hash browns he wasn't supposed to, and when he heard Mimi and Frampy talking to someone outside interested in buying their house, he panicked and threw the hash browns out the window. This was, as Mimi told us years later, a weird sight for someone to see when they're trying to find a new place to live. By the end, though, the tone of our talk changed. I would say that this was largely because of a story Dad told us, except he didn't tell us. He glared exclusively at Herb and Linda when he told it, as though they were the only three people in the room. Once, when he was young, he and a girl from one of the neighbors' houses were playing with a lighter, and he accidentally burned her with it. When Linda found out, she punished him. "You made me put my finger over a lighter because you said you wanted me to know what fire feels like," he said. At the time, the energy in his stare told me everything I needed to know about their relationship. This was his chance to speak. Now he was giving them a small burn. Before I sat down with Mimi and Jackson for dinner in the summer of 2015, weeks before my father's release date, I knew the basics of his life and of their raising him, but none of the depth. Now that I was moving into adulthood, Mimi decided it was time to tell me the whole story. In January of 1974, a French soldier, a black man by the name of Leon, was stationed in what is now called Ho Chi Minh City, Vietnam, but at the time was called Saigon. While there, Leon had a one-night stand with a waitress at a local bar named Mae Linh. My father was born 9 months later, on October 24, 1974. Mae Linh was very poor and lived with close family in Da Nang, family that would not agree to help raise an interracial child. So she, with the help of her sister, tried to raise him on her own. But within a few months, it became apparent to them that they alone didn't have the means to take care of this abnormally large, hungry baby, so they decided the best thing to do for him was give him to a local orphanage. Meanwhile in the States, a young married couple, Herb and Linda Roland, were living in Washington State with their young daughter, Stephanie, and were looking to adopt a Korean baby. They'd been stuck in the process for years, waiting, until one day they finally got some news from the adoption agency. They didn't have any Korean babies, but they did have a Vietnamese one, a 5-month-old. Herb and Linda said yes. Within a few weeks, they got a call that Mimi could only describe as shady. They were told to show up very early the next morning at a nearby airport, where their new child would arrive. When my father was brought to them from the plane, she saw that he was incredibly dirty. He had some shit on him, too. They brought him home that night, and one of Mimi's close family members, Jeannie, came to help them settle and clean him up. But from the very beginning, Mimi said, they could tell something was wrong. "He absolutely hated being touched," she told me, "and that whole night he never stopped crying." Jeannie took a shift holding the crying baby and went to Linda, looking frightened. "I think this was a mistake," she said. From that point all the way up until they kicked him out of the house at age 18, they would be reluctant combatants in a war against my father. He would act out, they would punish him, he would build resentment and act out again, they would punish him harder, and as long as he lived under their roof, the trenches would never be vacated. Throughout his childhood, they fought hard to keep him under control, beating him with wooden spoons, sending him to bed without dinner. He once told me he was so hungry he traded a G.I. Joe for a pack of crackers. Burning him, apparently. But nothing ever kept him out of trouble. That's when she told me the part that even my father didn't know. When he was in the 7th grade, things got so hostile that Linda went to her husband and said she wanted to give him back to the adoption agency. They were both at the edge, and they knew it was the only way to end their problems. But Herb turned her down. His father was an alcoholic who used to come home at night and beat his family, and his conscience could never be clean knowing that he sent my father into the foster system where that could happen. So, it was decided that they would endure, and for the next decade plus, the resentment she had for him would split a chasm down the middle of their marriage. Since they were going to be stuck with him for the next 5 years, they decided to take him to see a specialist, but she returned to them with the bad news. Your child is a sociopath and he will never love anyone. When my father got into his mid-teen years, he was able to escape the house, and he and his friends would go out and do what he only ever referred to as stupid, harmless shit, like shooting pellet guns at streetlights. But soon he would end up with frequent run-ins with the law and a bad reputation that would exact its revenge on him years later. In high school, he also met my mom, and they continued dating even after he dropped out. When she was in her freshman year of college, she got pregnant with me, and my mother's father gave him a place to stay in a house while he worked to help take care of me. At the end of the story, Mimi told me that for a while, when I was young, things were peaceful. They watched him grow up from afar. He had a son, a steady job, a long-term girlfriend. "We were proud of your dad. We really were," she said. The time they were talking about was when I was between the ages of 8 and 12, when Dad had an on-and-off but still relatively steady relationship with my unofficial stepmother, Rachel. But one day, when he came to pick me up from another overnight with Jackson, they gave him a tour of the house they'd just moved into, a bulky home tucked away in a rural cove of West Lafayette, Indiana. When he looked around at the location, he said something to the effect of, "This is all isolated and quiet. It'd be easy for somebody to come up here and kill people." They were terrified. By the time we had this conversation, Mimi had recently been diagnosed with cancer, and she'd had time to reflect on how she felt about her life. She told me some of the basics. She wished she had experimented more and didn't get married at 18. She wished she took more risks. But then I asked her the big question: if she could change one thing about her life, what would it be? She didn't need much time to pause. "I wouldn't have adopted your dad," she said. Understanding what it means to be another person is impossible. Understanding what it means to be Mark Van Roland is grueling. Sometimes people will try to tell you who they are, and sometimes in doing so, they'll actually tell you who they want to be. My father almost exclusively does the latter. He wants his skin and organs to be made of diamonds, rooted deep into the earth while still being unmoved by its turning, restraining its senselessness and deceit far away from his borders. He wants a fortress on these borders, one with barbed walls that makes it just as hard to get out as it is to get in. He would like for the halls of this fortress to be loud and lively, but no one ever stays. I heard him say once, when I was in my early teens, one of the most honest things I've ever heard. It was after we had moved out of the house that my stepmother lived in, and the only words of the conversation that I ever remembered were the last ones. He reflected and said, "I don't know how to love nobody." But I don't think I really understood my father until what may have been our last conversation. I was a sophomore in college, home for Christmas, and we had a blowout fight where I eventually cut him out of my life. But before that, he told me how he really looked at things. "I hate this," he said, waving to his small room. He'd left the mother of his newborn second child and was now renting space in a small house with a roommate he hated. "I hate all this. I don't care about how Grandma and Grandpa are doing. I just ask people that shit because that's what you do. To be honest, I don't care about 90% of the stuff that you say. I just want you to do well because I didn't. I would kill myself so you could live on." In the chaos of the moment, I didn't register the weight of what he was saying, but it would hit me about 8 months later. My mother gave me required daily Bible reading when I was younger. I remember coming across a verse in Exodus about how the iniquity of fathers is always visited on their sons. I had a few solid weeks of anxiety because in my 10-year-old brain, I thought this meant that sons were doomed to repeat the mistakes of their fathers. For someone whose father never graduated high school, got his mother pregnant when she was 19, and had served several years in prison, that verse was the last thing I wanted to read. I never wanted to see the inside of a police car. So when I actually did, years later, I couldn't help but notice the irony. I just confessed in tears to a therapist that I didn't want to be alive anymore, and that I was thinking about locking myself in a garage and turning the car on. In that moment, as three police officers came up, put me in handcuffs, and walked me outside the building, with a soul-shattering weight in my chest, I finally understood what Dad had meant all those months ago. He was a man without fear because he had nothing to lose. He could always look around and see nothing but things he hated. Mom once told me she was worried about him not going to heaven, and around the same time he told me he'd felt like he'd already been to hell. In his 40 years, he'd lived a century's worth of pain, and he'd spent them trying to make that pain his best friend. He'd been trapped in the hinges of time's back door, where the past offers no respite and the future no hope, biding his time until the world ends. And when you're finally ready to leave this world, nothing in it ever feels like it can hurt you. When I got there myself, I finally got what I wanted. I had no fear, just like him. My hands didn't shake like they used to. I'd finally made it to the scrap heap, the big jail caging the world where only the hardest survive, and bad men rise to the top to rule over empires of nothing. And I was paying the price. So when they sat me down in the police car, despite everything around me looking like a shadow of the real world, a part of me couldn't help but cough out a laugh when I thought back to that verse from all those years ago. I really was my father's son.
Hi, Isaac. Thank you so much for being here on Off the Page and reading that incredible essay for us. I guess my first question is just, you know, what was the genesis of this piece? Obviously, it draws inspiration from your life, but what inspired the writing of this particular essay?
Yeah, so I was a junior at the time. This is my junior winter, and I was in a class called Immersion Writing with Molly Antipol. And, you know, immersion writing is the kind of creative nonfiction where you find a particular environment or scene that you kind of immerse yourself in and write about it. And I had a few ideas, and they all just flopped miserably in terms of their feasibility. So then we were kind of coming up on the first class where we had to read what we had so far, and I didn't have, you know, anything really set up. So I thought I would just write about my own life. And this was also kind of at a particularly, you know, emotionally volatile time in my life. And so I think in a lot of ways, this was kind of, you know, a story I needed to tell for me. And then what kind of started as doing it just because I didn't have anything else, I think it turned into something much longer than I anticipated. But yeah, I think it just kind of came about out of multiple necessities, I'd say.
Had you taken English 91? Had you written nonfiction before this piece?
No, I hadn't. This was my first, because I did the prose track within prose. I did fiction for the creative writing minor. So I hadn't done any other nonfiction classes.
That's extremely impressive.
Thank you.
I think what's most amazing to me about this piece is that you're writing about obviously material that is so difficult, but also some of it's so recent, like some of those final moments are not that far in the past. And conventional wisdom is that you need a certain amount of distance from really tough material in order to write about it, whether you're doing it in fiction or nonfiction or prose. And I don't know, like, do you feel like you were writing with that kind of distance, or do you feel like you were writing while you were still inside it in some way?
Yeah, I mean, it's a little bit of both because, you know, when I wrote this, it was maybe 7 or 8 months after where the story ends. But I think in a lot of ways too, because so much of it is taking place like many, many years in the past and over a long period of time, I think I was writing with a distance that allowed me to kind of see how the present was kind of reflective of the past. You know, in a way, I think it felt more like, you know, even though the story had ended recently, I was kind of dealing with all the old things coming full circle. And so I think that's mainly like the connection I'm kind of drawing at the end there. And it was kind of the connection that had been on my mind ever since. So since I'm dealing with such a long period of time, I'm kind of working with distance and also kind of getting it down while it's fresh at the same time.
Yeah, I think that's a delicate balance, right? Because you don't want something that you have such distance from that you're so sort of in control of that it doesn't necessarily feel compelling to you anymore or necessarily alive in the right way. But it also just, you know, I know from my own experiences and from so many writers I know that dealing with that kind of material that's so close to you and so recent is difficult. But I think it's also maybe like what I hear you saying is that you can get to a point where something maybe has resolved in the real life situation that allows you to sum up a longer experience. I'm curious, the piece encompasses a lot. When I began reading, I think, okay, this is going to be about you and your father and the sort of lessons of toxic masculinity, and it encompasses other things. There's a section on the comic book store robbery and the sort of recreation of that, and encompasses family history. I'm curious, just from a drafting point of view, did the essay always contain all that, or did it sort of evolve and expand over time?
Yeah, I added to it as I went along just due to its length. Didn't have time to write it all, you know, in the one or two sittings I did before I had to do my first reading in class. So, you know, I wrote it in bits, but to me, they were always essential parts of the story, because I don't think, you know, without that kind of background and kind of delving into that story, I don't think it would have really afforded us the same opportunity to see and understand my father and also me in a way. So I thought they were always, you know, parts that I couldn't do without when I was writing it.
I'm also wondering, portraying a lifelong relationship, even though it's a relationship that has been marked by absences, it would seem as if there's just so much material that one could include. Moments, memories, scenes, information. And I think that may be partially why I'm so impressed that it's your first piece of nonfiction, because it does distill what seems to be a very, very complex relationship and a complex person into only a few pages. Was it a struggle to know what to include, what not to include? Or did it all sort of seem self-evident in the drafting?
Yeah, I think on a practical level, it was just because I had actually looked up, I just searched my father's name on Google to see what would come up while I was writing the essay, and then that file came up. So, you know, it was just kind of a stroke of luck that it was there. But when I was writing, I didn't want to feel like I was just copying straight from that transcript. And so just on a practical level, I thought it was necessary to kind of add in like how I was feeling or thinking about it as I was reading. But I also think it, you know, it's helpful because this is a creative nonfiction piece to enter into the emotional spaces of that story where like a legal transcript can't. And I thought it was important to separate it that way too.
I feel like in all writing, fiction or non, when there's a sort of clarity of purpose, whether it's just intuition or whether there's this fundamental need to tell a story, a lot of these seemingly complicated technical and craft things kind of take care of themselves, which is maybe the case with this, which is obviously such an important story for you. You quote a lot of the sentencing in the essay, and I think what was interesting to me in reading that, and I'm not very familiar with the court system, but I was struck by some of the language you cited and by the lack of commentary that you, as the author of this essay, provide. And yet it felt to me, and perhaps I'm over reading or over interpreting, but it felt like there was an implicit critique in some of what you were selecting. I was really struck, for instance, by the part about like, oh, well, he didn't get a GED. And as if that was somehow relevant to whether you were going to get 7 years or 15 years. That felt really, really wrong to me. I'm curious if there is some feeling about the justice system that you are working through in quoting those sentencing guides.
I think in some ways, yeah. I mean, I have my own kind of opinions about all the inequities that exist in the justice system right now. You know, and one of the things that I didn't really talk about in there, but that I considered was, when you talk on the phone to someone in prison, there's a company that kind of runs that service called Global Tellink. And so that's kind of pay by minute phone call service. And they really make money off of there being prisoners who need to call home. So I think in a lot of ways, yeah, I think this story really kind of serves to highlight that. But I think the reason there's not much commentary on that is because I felt like the images and the scenes I outlined for that kind of speak for themselves. You know, I felt like it would have been not just redundant or distracting for me to include my own elaborations on my opinions there, but I think also part of what makes that critique kind of come through silently is the fact that we're so focused in on the story of one person, you know, and if I'd kind of put in my own commentary, I think that might have taken away from it being like a story about a person and turning into something slightly different.
Yeah, and I think for me, the critique speaks the more loudly for being sort of subtle and implicit. And like you said, this is not an argument against the inequities of the justice system, but it sort of contains that argument while still being a story about specific people, which feels important. Something else I find really impressive about your writing, Isaac, in this essay is this command of metaphor, of figurative language. There's a lot of really beautifully articulated feelings or moments. I'm thinking of a lot of the language describing Tracy like seeing a feral cat in the woods with a rusted collar, his life like a half-sized dresser, trying to console a time bomb. I also really love the sentence where you write later in the essay, I wasn't strong enough to scale the bastion between us. We could only communicate through the same little peephole in it that we'd always used. I'm curious if that kind of language is something that you feel comes naturally to you, or is it something that you sort of arrive at through trial and error? Because I think that's pretty rare in a young writer to have an instinct for abstraction like that.
Yeah, most of the metaphorical language that's used in that is stuff that I wrote the first time through. So I think it also might be a little different here just because the story is so personal, and I feel like it's easier for me to connect with the core emotions of that story in a way that it might be more difficult for other things that I've written. There were a few edits I made on the way, I think especially in that first portion that I read for class, which was maybe like the first 5 pages. There are a few points in there where Molly was like, oh, this is a little cliche, either maybe cut it or find a replacement. But yeah, the things that you read were all in there from the start.
This leads to my last question, which is, having had this experience writing this essay, and of course it won the 2020 Creative Nonfiction Undergraduate Prize, do you see yourself writing more in the future, full stop? And do you see yourself writing more nonfiction? Or what are sort of your thoughts about writing as you leave college and head out into adulthood?
Yeah, I definitely plan on writing more than have been in my spare time this quarter. Yeah, even though I'm teaching English next year, the plan is to apply to MFAs for the following year. So that would be the hope. As for the kind, I do a lot more fiction. I haven't done very much nonfiction. I don't think I've ever written like an extended piece since this one, but it is something that I enjoy and would like to go back to at some point. I've also been kind of returning to screenwriting recently, which was my first, you know, form that I was passionate about. And once I got into prose, I kind of took a long hiatus from it, and then I've now come back to it. So yeah, there's all different forms that I enjoy, but I definitely plan on writing in the future regardless.
Excellent. Well, I look forward to seeing it as it makes its way out into the world. Thank you so much, Isaac, for talking with me and for sharing your work.
Yeah, thank you for having me. It's an honor to be here.
Off the Page is produced in partnership with the Stanford Storytelling Project and the Creative Writing Program. Special thanks to Jonah Willingans, the director of the Stanford Storytelling Project, and Patrick Phillips, Christina Ablaza, and Danielle Huliganga of the Creative Writing Program. For their generous support, we'd like to thank the Vice Provost of Undergraduate Education, Stanford Arts, and Bruce Braden. This episode was produced by Alex Strong, Megan Kalfas, and Laura Joyce Davis. Our theme music is by Breakmaster Cylinder. For more Stanford writing, author events, and workshops, visit creativewriting.stanford.edu. You can find this and other episodes of Off the Page at storytelling.stanford.edu or anywhere you listen to podcasts. I'm Mark Lebowski. Thanks for listening.